with your day. I reached out a hand, offering to help her up. She ignored me, stretching to steal a half-peeled orange from the table instead. We have to do something. Shahzad smoothed her hands compulsively over the map that was rolled out on the table. It used to be a single, clean, crisp sheet of paper showing Miraji. Now it was a dozen different pieces showing far corners of the country, cities with the names of rebels stationed there, scrawled and crossed out, other pieces of paper overlapping one another as the desert shifted in our hands. There was a fresh note next to Saramotai. We can't just hide out in this desert forever, Ahmed. I recognized the beginning of the same argument that Shahzad and Ahmed had been having for months now. Shahzad kept saying we needed to take the rebellion to the capital if we wanted a shot at winning. Ahmed would say it was too risky, and Shahzad would say nobody ever won a war on the defensive. Ahmed rubbed two fingers across a spot at his hairline as he started his reply. There was a small scar there, almost invisible now. I'd noticed he rubbed it like it still hurt, though, every time he sent one of us off to do something that might be our death. Like that scar was where he kept his conscience. I didn't know how he'd gotten it. It was from the life Jin and Ahmed had before they came to Miraji. Jin had told me the stories behind some of his scars once, on one of those dark nights in the desert between camp and a mission, right after he'd earned a wound that would make a new scar, right below the tattoo of the sun on his chest. We were a long way from any holy father to patch us up, which left me. In the dark of his tent, my hand had traveled across his bare skin, finding new bumps and marks, while he told me where they'd come from. A drunk sailor's knife in a bar brawl in an Albish port. A broken bone on deck in a storm. Until my fingers found the one on his left shoulder, near the tattoo of the compass that was on the other side of his heart from the sun. That one, he'd said, so close to me that his breath stirred the hair that had escaped from the hasty knot on my head. Was from this bullet I caught in the shoulder when a pain-in-the-ass girl who was pretending to be a boy ditched me in the middle of a riot. Well, it's a good thing that pain-in-the-ass girl stitched you up, too, I joked, tracing his tattoo with my thumb. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Jin's mouth pull up in the smallest edge of a smile. God, I knew I was in trouble even then. I was running for my life, bleeding on your floor, and all I could think about was kissing you, and damn if we got caught. I told him that would have been idiotic, and then he'd kissed me until we were both stupid from it. What about Jin? It slipped out without my meaning it to, interrupting the argument that had been going through its usual steps while my head was in a tent in the middle of the sands. Ahmed shook his head, knuckles still resting against his forehead. No word. And you don't think it's worth sending someone after him like we did for Saida? It was out before I could check the anger in my words. So you are angry about Jin. Ahmed sounded tired. We're in the middle of a war. It would be petty of me to be mad about Ahmed sending Jin away while my life hung in the balance. I supposed I was petty then. We are. Somehow his calm made it that much worse. From the corner of my eye, I caught one of Shahzad's looks, only this one was traded with Hala instead of me. Too quick for me to read. Hala shoved the last piece of the orange into her mouth, finally getting to her feet, stepping away so she was clear of me. That wasn't an answer, Ahmed said to me. You think I was wrong for sending Jin to spy on the Xichian? when foreigners warring with my father are the only thing keeping him at bay? Well, it doesn't seem like it matters anymore, I snapped. The Sultan is back on our territory anyway, judging by all those dead soldiers we left in Saramotai. Damn, I hadn't meant to say that. I tried a different track. I just think there might have been another way. That didn't come out right either, even if I had been thinking it for months. Ahmed linked his hands on top of his head. The gesture was so much like Jin, it made me even angrier. You don't think I should have sent my brother out for the good of the country, for your sake? I think you could have waited to send him away. My temper broke, and suddenly I was shouting. Shahzad drew forward like she was going to stop me from saying something I might regret. At least until I woke up from being shot for your rebellion. I'd never seen Ahmed's temper flare before, but I knew I'd pushed too far even before his voice rose. He asked to go, Amani. The words were simple enough, but it took me a heartbeat to understand them all the same. Shahzad and Hala had both gone still, watching the exchange. I didn't send him away. Ahmed's voice wasn't raised anymore, but it hadn't lost any of its strength. He asked me for something that would take him away from here, and from you. I tried to talk him out of it, but I love my brother enough that I didn't want him to have to watch you die either. And I have spent the last 2 months lying to protect you. But I don't have time to keep you from acting out some misguided defiance against me because you think it's my fault he's gone. Hurt and anger warred inside me, and I didn't know which one I wanted to pay attention to first. I wanted to call him a liar, but I knew I wouldn't be able to. Everything he was saying sounded true. Truer than Ahmed sending Jin away with no care for either of us. Truer than Jin going against his will. I had almost died, and Jin was going to let me do it alone. Amani. Ahmed knew me as well as anyone. He knew my instinct was to run, and I knew it too. I could feel the itch building in my legs. He went from ruler to friend again, reaching for me, trying to stop me. But I was already out of his reach, pushing out of the stifling dark of the pavilion and into the mockingly bright sun of the oasis. Chapter 8. Last time I'd seen Jin had been a few heartbeats before I was shot in the stomach. We were in Ilyaz, the key to the Middle Mountains. So long as Ilyaz was in the Sultan's hands, there was no easy way into Eastern Miraji, meaning there was no way to take Isman and with it, the throne. It was supposed to be a simple reconnaissance mission, but it turned out we weren't the only enemies of the Sultan to figure out that winning Ilyaz could mean winning Miraji. Ilyaz was under siege from both the Albish and the Gamenix armies. I didn't know where either of those countries were, but Jin pointed out the flags on their tents as we lay flat on the mountaintop looking over their camps. And it turned out the young prince who was leading the army in Ilyaz was a damn sight better as a commander than his brother Naguib had been. He was holding his own in the mountain fortress against two armies at once, with minimal losses. Even Shahzad was impressed. But she thought she could find a way through the siege all the same. That was, give or take, how we wound up in the middle of a skirmish between the emir of Ilyaz's first command and two foreign armies. And the Ilyaz first command was a whole lot bigger than any of us had expected. I didn't remember much from that fight. Blasts of gunpowder sparking the night air from both sides, cries in tongues I didn't know, and blood dashing across the dusty rocks. Shazad, a whirlwind of steel, cutting our way out of the fight. Me, with the desert at my fingertips. Jin leveling his gun at Mirajin and foreigner alike. A scrape of bullet grazing my arm, untethering my power with just one iron kiss. Seeing the knife that was about to go through Jin's back, a heartbeat before he saw it. A heartbeat that mattered in keeping him alive. Grabbing the pistol off my belt. I stepped out of my cover and straight into the line of fire. The man with the knife went down with one pull of my trigger. Only there was another gun behind him, aimed at me, by a dark-haired Mirajin soldier with a steady hand. His bullet tore straight through me, like I wasn't genie fire and desert sand at all, just flesh and blood. Everything I knew about what happened next were things I was told after I woke up. Jin had grabbed me as I'd fallen, cutting three men down between us as he went. I was bleeding so badly it looked like half my life was already on my clothes by the time he got to me. Shazad carved a path out of the last of the fray with a few swings of her swords, and they got me onto Iz's back. He was shaped as a giant rock come to rescue us. Only there was no time to get me all the way back to our camp. I would have died first. They stopped at the first town they saw with a prayer house. It was on the Sultan's side of the country. Enemy ground. Iz, back in his human shape, made the Holy Father swear he would heal me, not harm me, then repeated it to make sure it was true before they handed me over. Shazad dragged Jin away when he tried to make the Holy Father work with a gun to his head. The Holy Father didn't try to kill me, though I heard I came pretty close to dying once or twice all on my own. The bullet had just missed about three different ways of killing me. I'd only barely stopped bleeding by the time they had to move me again. The Holy Father warned them against it, but Iz had been spotted. They got me back to camp as quickly as they could and handed me over to our Holy Father. It turned out it was being a Demji that had saved me. I'd burned away any chance of infection, quick and hot, all on my own, so the only thing the Holy Father had to worry about was the bleeding. Near a week had passed the next time I opened my eyes, fighting my way out of a haze of drugs that had been forced down me along with water. Shazad was asleep next to me. That was how I knew I must have been close to death. The sick tent had been Bahi's territory. She hadn't set foot in it since he'd died, not even when she'd gotten hurt herself, the one time I'd ever seen a sword get past her guard. I'd stitched the thin slice across her arm instead. She woke instantly as soon as I shifted, her eyes flying open, going for a weapon that wasn't there, before focusing on me. Well, look who's back from the dead. Shazad found me in one of the pools of water that had been designated for washing. Dark clothes hung between the trees on all sides to shield it from view of the camp. It was shallow enough that I could sit in it and be covered up to my shoulders, and clear enough that I could see my toes at the bottom. The bottom of the pool was scattered with white and black pebbles, smoothed by the water. I pushed them around the bottom with my toes. I'd been in here long enough that I'd scrubbed the dust out of my hair, and it had already dried in strange, wild waves, curling around the edges of my scalp like it had a habit of doing. I was carefully using sand to scrub away the flecks of blood that were still clinging to the wound at my collarbone from Saramotai. I'd thought about going to the Holy Father for stitches, but I figured he had enough on his hands with the refugee women, including the one who had called me by my mother's name. I didn't know if she'd have woken up yet, but if she had, that was another reason to steer clear of the sick tent. Shazad had stripped the desert off herself, too. She was wearing a white and yellow kalat that reminded me of the uniform of Miraji. It made her desert skin look all that much darker against the paleness of the linen. She had a bundle tucked under one arm. Jin has as much flight in him as he has fight, you know, Shahzad said. That's how Ahmed wound up alone in Isman in the first place. I knew the story. When Ahmed had chosen to stay in the country where he was born, Jin had decided to move on, staying on the ship they'd been working on. He'd come back a few months later with Delilah after his mother died. He did it at the Sul team trials, too. She shucked off her shoes. Vanished the night before and came back with a black eye and cracked rib he never explained to any of us. He got in a brawl in a bar with a soldier about a girl. Huh. Shahzad considered that, rolling up her shalwar. She sat at the edge of the pool, dipping her feet in to cool off. The sounds of the camp drifted around us on the slight breeze, birdsong mingling with indistinct voices. All right, we're low on time, so I'm going to hurry this up. You're going to ask me if I knew he'd asked to leave, and I'm going to tell you that I didn't. And you're going to believe me because I've never lied to you before, which is half the reason you like me so much. Well, she wasn't wrong about that. What's the other half, if you were so clever? That you'd be constantly undressed if it wasn't for me. The bundle under her arm unfurled into a culotte I'd seen at the bottom of her trunk of clothes before. It was the color of the sky in the last moments before it turned to full desert night and dotted with what looked like tiny stars. I realized, as it clinked in Shahzad's hands, that it wasn't stitching. They were gold beads. I hadn't exactly arrived at the rebellion with enough clothing to fight a war, but Shahzad had enough for the two of us, even if nothing of hers ever fit me exactly right. But this was by far the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen her pull out of that chest of clothes. What's the occasion? I asked, dragging myself through the water to lean on the edge of the pool next to her. Navid has somehow convinced Emin to marry him. I sucked in a breath so fast, I inhaled some of the water and started coughing. Shahzad slapped me on the back a few times. Navid had been totally taken with Emin from the moment he arrived at the camp. It didn't seem to matter what shape Emin wore. Navid could spy the object of his affections across the camp without hesitating. He had very drunkenly declared his love on Equinox a few months back, in front of the entire camp. I remembered grabbing Shahzad's arm, bracing myself for the inevitable mockery and rejection from Emin. For some baffling reason, it never came. Baffling because Emin treated everyone but Hala with the sort of disdain that came only from true hurt. The kind the rebellion had saved the Demji from in the first place. Emin had glanced around at all the staring faces with sardonic yellow eyes before asking us why we didn't have anything more interesting to stare at. Then Emin slipped a hand into Navid's, pulling him away from the firelight and our stunned silence. You have to attend, Shahzad said as I recovered from my attempt to breathe in water. And you have to be dressed to do it. Emin has already stolen 3 kalats from me for the occasion because, and I quote, none of my own clothes fit at the moment. I raised my eyebrows at her. Did you point out that Emin's a shapeshifter and can make anything fit? You know I did. Shahzad pulled an annoyed face. It went down about as well as you would expect, and now I'm down 3 more kalats. You're going to run out of clothes at this rate. And when that day comes, I will lead a mission to Emin's tent to reclaim the spoils. But for now, I managed to save this. She gestured at the white linen clinging to her perfectly. And this. And I know where to reclaim this one from because you sleep 4 feet away from me. I ran my finger and thumb along the hem of the culotte she held out to me, my hand already dry in the unforgiving sun. I remembered something she'd told me once on one of those dark nights when neither of us could sleep and we stayed awake talking until we ran out of words or out of night. When she'd told her parents she was throwing her lot in with Ahmed, her father gave her those swords to fight the rebellion with. Her mother gave her that culotte. That's the culotte you're supposed to wear into Isman when we win this war. If we win. We're still a long way from Isman, Shahzad said as if she'd heard the if I didn't voice. Might as well not let it rot at the bottom of my trunk. You can wear it if you swear to me you won't get blood on it. It's dangerous to ask a Demji to make a promise, I said. Promises were like truth-telling. They would come true, just not in the way you might expect. It's a wedding, Amani. Shahzad reached a hand down to help me out of the water. Even you aren't that good at getting into trouble. In Dustwalk, marriages happened fast. Most girls just dug out their best culottes, worn thin from years of sisters and mothers handing them down, and draped their shimas over their heads to hide their faces in that uncertain time between engagement and marriage, lest a ghoul or genie notice a woman who belonged to no one, no longer a daughter but not yet a wife either, and try to claim her for his own. We didn't have a prayer house in camp, but we'd always made do. The Holy Father had prepared the ceremony in a clear space at the edge of the sand, where the ground sloped up just enough to give a good view of the whole camp below in the last of the light. The wedding began at dusk, the sun setting over the canyon. Like they always did. A time of change in the day for a moment of change in two lives. Emin wasn't wearing a repurposed shima. It was a true wedding covering, made of fine cloth stitched with bright thread, and when the sun hit it, I could just see the outline of the face she had chosen through the thin yellow muslin. It wasn't one I'd seen on her before. Emin was our best spy, staying alive by looking unremarkable. But the face she'd chosen today was stunning, and she was beaming like I'd never seen Emin smile. Hala caught my gaze as the two of them knelt in the sand side by side. It had been an unspoken pact between us Demji to keep one eye on Emin after that night Navid declared his love for her. None of us had ever seen Emin's walls drop for anyone in camp before Navid. Emin and Hala might share a genie father, but by the sound of things, they couldn't have had more different mothers. Rumor had it, Hala had torn her mother's mind apart, driving her crazy on purpose because she hated the woman so much. The rebellion had found Emin in a prison, waiting for execution at the hands of the Galen. Emin had spent 16 years hidden in the house of grandparents who shielded their daughter's Demji child. Alone and lonely, but safe. Until the day Emin's grandmother collapsed from the heat on their doorstep. Emin was otherwise alone in the house. The 16-year-old waited, hoping a neighbor would notice. But finally, desperate, Emin ran out to help, wearing the same slender girl's form she'd donned to fight the heat that morning. The body was too weak to drag a grown woman, though. Emin shifted into a man's shape out in the open. Word reached the Galen. They killed Emin's whole family on the same doorstep as they tried to block the soldier's path. Until Navid, Emin had treated anyone who wasn't a Demji with distrust. Even me, on account of how I'd thought I was human for 16 years. It would take the slightest misstep from Navid to send Emin back behind walls. But even Hala hadn't been able to find anything wrong with him, and she'd been trying real hard. Anyone could see the way Navid looked at Emin, and it didn't change no matter what body our shapeshifter wore, woman or man, Mirajin or foreign. The Holy Father stood between Navid and Emin as they faced us, sitting in the sand, legs crossed. He recited the usual blessings for a wedding as he filled two large clay bowls with fire. He handed one to Emin and one to Navid. He spoke of how humanity was made by the first beings out of water and earth, carved by wind, and lit with a spark of genie fire. He reminded us that when Princess Hawa and Atala became the first mortals ever to wed, their fires were twinned and burned so much brighter for it. All these centuries later, we still uttered the same words they had. As he spoke, we came up, one by one, the women of the camp to Emin, the men to Navid. Each of us dropped something of ours into their fire to bless the union. In Dustwalk, I'd always given an empty bullet casing or a lock of hair. I didn't have anything else to give. For the first time in my life, I had more, and I'd had to think about what I ought to give, as Shahzad and I got ready. For just a second, my fingers had drifted over the red Shima, the one Jin had given me in the burned-out mountain mining town of Sazi. As I closed my eyes for Shahzad to press dark coal into my lids, I could picture myself tossing it into the fire, watching the red cloth catch. It would go up in seconds. I was angry, but I didn't hate him. I'd fastened it around my waist like a sash instead, the way I always did with Shahzad's clothes. I stood behind Hala, who held her hand above the fire, pricking each of the remaining three fingers on her left hand with a needle in quick succession. Blood was the traditional offering from family members, even if the father Emin and Hala shared didn't bleed. Bright red dots welled at the tips of her golden fingers, then sizzled noisily as the blood hit the fire. As Hala moved out of the way, I held up my gift above the fire, and a handful of desert sand slipped out between my fingers, scattering into the flames. I caught the slightest hint of a smile from Emin as I stepped aside, leaving room for Shahzad to drop a small comb of hers into the fire. Next to her, Ahmed dropped a Sichuan coin into Navid's bowl. He wore a clean black kurta edged with red that made him look more like he belonged in a palace than in a rebellion. He and Shahzad made a well-matched pair, standing side by side in front of the twinned wedding fires. Behind Ahmed, the twins, Iz and Maz, were holding a blue feather, alternately snatching it out of each other's hands and shoving each other in a silent war over which one would get to drop it into the fire. The warning look Shahzad gave them as she turned around was loud enough to get them both to behave. When they spotted me standing on Emin's side of the fire, they waved frantically. I hadn't seen the twins since I'd been injured. They must have gotten back while we were in Saramotai. When the whole camp was done, finally Emin and Navid turned to face each other to speak their vows. I give myself to you. Emin carefully tipped her fire into the third bowl that the Holy Father held between them, the ashes of our gifts mingling with bright coal embers and sending up sparks as they spilled from one bowl to another. All that I am I give to you, and all that I have is yours. My life is yours to share until the day we die. Navid repeated the same as he tilted the contents of his bowl in after hers until a single fire, larger and brighter than the ones they had held alone, burned between them. The Holy Father waved his tattooed hands over it in blessing. There was a moment of silence as the sun disappeared entirely behind the canyon wall, casting the camp into a gloom broken only by the fire. And then Navid sprang to his feet, unabashedly picking Emin up, arms around her waist, before pulling her into a kiss. The whole of the camp cheered. The ceremony was over. It was time for the celebrations to begin. Amani! I didn't have a chance to turn around to see who'd called my name. A pair of bright blue arms grabbed me around the waist, spinning me around gleefully. I laughed, shoving Iz off as my feet found the ground again, staggering. Maz was wearing clothes, but Iz had already stripped down to nothing but his trousers. The twins had a real aversion to clothes. Their animal shapes didn't need them, and it seemed to confuse them that their human shapes did. Iz gestured at the bare blue skin of his chest and my culotte. We match, he beamed stupidly at me. And luckily, only one of us had to take off our shirt. I see you both survived Amanpour. The Albish had made an alliance with our western neighbors of Amanpour, after losing Miraji to the Galen 20 years ago. According to Shazad, it had been nothing more than some men's signatures on paper, until the Albish suddenly got the news of the Galen being turned out of the desert. And then suddenly they were using that piece of paper to convince Amanpour to let them camp on their borders, waiting for an opportune moment to try to claim Miraji as a prize again. They were getting a little too close to us for comfort, so the twins had been sent to spy on the Albish troops camped along our western border, in case they got itchy feet and decided to march through our half of the desert. The last thing we needed was a fight on two fronts. Elephants! Iz flung up his arms so excitedly I staggered back, nearly stumbling into the fire at the strange foreign word. Amanpour has elephants. Did you know about elephants? Were you holding out on us? Maz slung an arm around his brother's bare shoulders, pointing at me accusingly. It was easy to forget one of them was blue, and the other one just had blue hair when they were like this, moving and talking like one person. Maz's dark-skinned arm almost seemed like an extension of his brother's body. Iz winked. Fess up, Demji! I rolled my eyes at them. If I did, I probably would have kept it from you anyway, judging by the slightly crazy look in your eyes. Do you want to see one? Maz was already kicking off his shoes. We might need more space. Iz started to gesture around himself, as if trying to get people out of the way. There was no way this could end well. Is this going to be like the time you learned what a rhinoceros was all over again? The twins froze, swapping a sheepish expression. I mean, elephants are slightly bigger, so then how about you show me some time when there aren't quite so many people who aren't quite so full of liquor around, I suggested. The twins traded a look as they seemed to silently debate the wisdom of that versus how badly they wanted to show me their new trick. Finally, they nodded and contented themselves with giving me a very detailed explanation of what elephants looked like and telling me nothing else about how Amanpour had gone. Well, I suppose we weren't invaded yet. Torches were lit. Music had started, and with it, dancing and eating and drinking. I was grateful to know that for a few hours we wouldn't be fighting a war. It was on nights like this in the rebel camp that I believed more than anything in what we could do. Nights when everyone stopped fighting long enough to live like we were promising the rest of Miraji it could. It was a few hours after dark when I spotted him through the crowd. I'd had enough to drink that I didn't trust my eyes at first. He was a flash of an impression as I spun. Head tilted back, laughing, at ease, like I'd seen him 1,000 times. I lost my step, staggering too close to the fire. Someone grabbed me, pulling me back before I could set Shahzad's clothes aflame. I tore myself out of the dancing and looked back, searching for him through the hazy mess of faces in the dark. But he was gone, as quick as if I'd imagined him. No, there. The crowd split. Jin. He was back. He was standing on the other side of the fire, still wearing his traveling clothes, dust clinging to his dark hair. He looked like he hadn't shaved lately either. I had a sudden flash of the last time he'd kissed me when he'd been a few days without a razor. My heart stumbled towards him, but I caught it, fighting to right it. I turned away quickly before he could spot me. I wasn't in any kind of state to face him now. My head was fuzzy with alcohol and exhaustion. I looked for Shahzad. She was a few paces away, deep in conversation with Ahmed, hands moving as quick as the dance of insects around a fire as she argued something passionately, and a little tipsily. Shahzad wasn't much for unnecessary motions when she was sober. But when she caught my eye, she read me like an open book all the same. I gave a small nod behind myself. Her gaze steadied, like it did when she was trying to track down an enemy in a fight. I saw the shock register on her face the moment she spied him. Good. That meant it was really him, not some conjuring by Hala designed to torture me. I had hoped that by the time I saw him again, I'd be ready to face him head on. But now I felt split open. Like if I faced him, it was all going to come spilling out in words. I wiped away the sweat on my neck. My hand came away red. For one stupid moment, I thought seeing Jin really had split me open. No, the wound across my collarbone had reopened. The rushed patch-up job in Saramotai hadn't fared all that well against the dancing and drinking. Shahzad had called it a scratch, but right now it looked a lot like an escape to me. Jin had run away. Fine, I could do the same. The warmth and noise of the camp faded behind me as I picked my way toward the Holy Father's tent, set far to one side of the camp. It had changed some since it had been Bahi's domain, the place I'd first woken up in camp under a canopy of cloth stars. But that didn't make it any easier when I had to step inside. Half a year since Bahi had died at my brother's hands, and I still thought I could smell burning flesh sometimes when I got too close to where he'd worked. It was no wonder Shahzad steered clear. I'd known him a handful of weeks. She'd known him half her life. The new Holy Father had kept his patchwork of stars. It was the first thing I saw as I pushed my way into the tent. A woman's head darted up from one of the beds. I hadn't been expecting anyone to be here. Leastways, not anyone awake. In the bed nearest to the entrance, Saida was sleeping still as the dead. Across from her was a young rebel whose name escaped me, bandaged from elbow to wrist where there used to be a hand. He'd been dosed with something that would keep him dreaming he still had 10 fingers by the look of things. And in the third bed, I'd almost forgotten about the woman we'd brought unconscious from Saramotai, the one who'd called me by my mother's name. Seemed she wasn't unconscious anymore. Sorry. I hovered, holding one tent flap back, looking for an excuse. Only I didn't need one. I belonged here, more than she did. So why was I shuffling my feet like I was a kid back in Dust Walk again? I didn't mean to wake you. I'm just bleeding. I held up my hand, like I needed to prove it to this stranger. The Holy Father isn't here. The woman pushed herself to her elbows. Her eyes darted around frantically in the dim lamplight, like she was looking for some escape of her own. "He's still at the celebrations." I finally stepped over the threshold and let the tent flap fall shut. I tried not to look at Saida as I pressed forward. "I just came for supplies." I'd been stuck in this tent for a good long while after I woke up from nearly dying. I could have drawn every corner of it from memory, down to the iron and wood chest emblazoned with holy words where the Holy Father kept his supplies. "It's locked," the woman said as I dropped down next to the chest. "I know." I reached up for the small blue glass oil lamp that the Holy Father always kept burning when there was someone in the sick tent overnight. Nobody ought to be left to suffer and die in the dark. I felt around the base until my fingers closed around the tiny iron key that he kept lodged there. The trunk lock gave way with a satisfying click. Inside were rows and rows of bottles and needles and powders and tiny knives all neatly lined up. It was so unlike Bahi's mess of tools and supplies scattered out across the ground that it almost hurt a little. Like there was less of him left in camp every day since he died. "Believe it or not, this isn't my first visit," I said over my shoulder, as I picked out a bottle of something clear I'd seen the Holy Father clean wounds with before and put it to one side. I held the set of needles up to the light, squinting. I'd never noticed how big they looked until now, but I had to figure one of them was smaller than the others. "You're going to sew yourself up?" she asked from behind me, like she didn't know whether she ought to be appalled or impressed. "Not the first time for that, either." I picked a needle at random before turning around to face her head on. She looked a whole lot better than she had when we'd found her in that cell in Saramotai, and she'd barely been able to focus on me. Her fever seemed to have broken, and she was alert now, her face almost a normal color. She started, and then hesitated, running her tongue along cracked lips. "I've got some talent with healing, if you'd rather not." I didn't need her help. I could take the supplies and leave. I could forget I'd ever been the girl from Dustwalk who had a mother named Zahia. But if I left now, I'd have to face Jin. And I was having trouble thinking of a single time running away from my problems had actually worked. Besides, it wasn't like I was all that excited about shoving a sharp object into my own skin. I sat across from her, handing over the bottle, thread, and needle. She seemed skittish as she pulled away the collar of the kalat. Her fingers drifted over the wound, dabbing the liquid over where the blood had caked, making 100 tiny pinpricks of pain sing behind it. But I wasn't paying it much mind. I was watching her face in the dim glow of the lamplight, trying to recognize something there I might know. "You've been drinking," she said finally. "I can smell it on you. That'll be why it started again. Thins the blood. You don't need stitches, just a bandage, and to learn how to hold your drink." It was the way she said drink that made me sure. Her accent had been worn smooth by years in other places, places that didn't swallow that word like they were always thirsty. But there was no mistaking it, not with the way the rest of the words dropped and rose. I could have picked out that accent in the cacophony of a bazaar. It was my accent. "You called me Zahia," I said, biting the bullet so fast I didn't have time to lose my nerve. "That was my mother's name. Zahia al-Hiza." I watched her close for a reaction. "But she was born Zahia al-Fadi." The woman's face folded like a bad hand of cards. She pulled away from me, dropping the collar of my culotte, and pressed the back of her hands to her lips, stifling what sounded like a sob. I stared at her, unsure of what to do. I ought to give her some privacy or some comfort, but I couldn't tear my gaze away from her. "That would make you a Mani, then." Her voice sounded choked when she finally spoke again. She shook her head angrily as if to dispel the tears. Desert girls didn't cry. "You look exactly like Zahia at your age." I'd heard that before. She reached out a hand like she was going to touch me. There were tears in her eyes. "It's like seeing my sister the day I left Dustwalk all over again." "Your sister?" I pulled away before her fingers could so much as graze my cheek. "You're Safiya Al-Fadi?" I saw it as soon as she said it. I might be the spitting image of my mother, but I saw her in this woman, too. She was the middle sister of the three Al-Fadi girls. My mother and Aunt Farah's mythical third sister. The one who had famously vanished out of Dustwalk to make her own life. Who my mother always talked about running away to find. Who I'd been headed for when I first left Dustwalk. Before I'd chosen Jin and the Rebellion. "You're supposed to be an Isman." "I was an Isman." She suddenly busied herself, pulling bottles out of the Holy Father's trunk, checking them over with a quick, practiced eye. "I went there to find my fortune. I was there for nearly 17 years. She uncorked one without a label to sniff the contents, carefully avoiding meeting my eye. I didn't like that she was here. It didn't seem right that in this whole huge, sprawling desert, we would find each other somewhere neither of us was ever meant to be. It seemed like the world had bent itself over backwards trying to push us together. Had I done this? I raked my mind for the things I'd said in the days Jin and I had walked across the desert, when I'd still thought I was going to wind up in Isman. Had I told some truth by accident? Before I'd known I was Demji and that I couldn't lie? Before I'd understood how dangerous it was to speak truths about the future, that it would twist the universe to make them true? All I'd have to have done was tell Jin I was going to find my aunt, and the universe would rearrange the stars to make it so, and give me some kind of poisoned version of the truth. Or was this just dumb luck? Her nervous fingers finally settled on a bottle. She tipped out something thick and foul-smelling onto her fingertips and dabbed it across my wound. "So how come you left Isman?" "Because fortune is a funny thing." I waited, but it seemed that was all the explanation I was going to get for how she'd wound up in Saramotai. Though I must admit, I didn't think it was going to lead me to being imprisoned by a revolutionary who wanted to overturn the world order. "Malik wasn't ours," I argued, wincing against the pressure of her fingers on my collarbone. "Do you handpick all your followers?" She pressed a little harder on my wound than she needed to. "He did things in your prince's name. That's enough for me. He nearly killed me doing it, too. You know, some of this desert didn't ask for a rebellion that might get us killed." She pulled away from me, wiping her fingers on a cloth. "But I suppose, as the Holy Father in Dustwalk would have said, fortune and fate." 3 words, and I was standing back in the prayer house in Dustwalk all over again, being preached to. That was an old expression the Holy Father used when times were hard. Fortune and fate. It meant that fortune and fate weren't always the same. I understood that better than anyone. "Here." My Aunt Sophia dusted her hands off quickly, pulling out another of the bottles from the Holy Father's chest. Take this for the pain. It'll help you sleep. It was her accent, mingled with those words, talk of sleep and medicines, that drew the memory out of the corner of my mind. Tamid. It hit me like a blow to the chest. I'd pushed down all thoughts of him for months now, but it was as if she'd summoned him here, with her dustwalk accent, the tiny bottle of medicine in the dim light, the sick longing for people I used to know. He was the only friend I had before this place and the rebellion, who used to stitch me up and sneak me things until the pain went away, who I left to die in the sand. Was this how truth-telling myself to my aunt would twist around on me? Reminding me of who I was before Ahmed's rebellion, of the people who'd suffered and died because of things I did? All of a sudden, taking something that would send me to sleep and away from that memory seemed awful tempting. But before I could take the bottle, the entrance to the tent flapped open violently. My head snapped around. My first thought was that Jin had followed me here. But through the lingering haze of drink, I saw two figures silhouetted in the light of the lamp against the backdrop of the dark outside. Jin would have come after me alone. And they were tangled together like two drunk wedding revelers looking for some privacy, stumbling into the wrong tent. Then they shifted, and the light caught the knife. I was on my feet in a heartbeat, even as I heard a voice I knew well choke out my name. It was Delilah. Chapter 9. The figures staggered backwards out from the tent, but it was too late to run. I was already on my feet. Stay here, I ordered Sophia, swiping up a knife as I went. Stop. The order came at me as I burst out of the sick tent after them. Before I could see clearly, before I even recognized the second figure holding Delilah hostage, dark hair flopping over his proud brow, his eyes panicked in a way I'd never seen before. Surprise staggered the strength in my voice. Mahdi? He was holding Delilah around her waist. A knife was pressed across her throat so hard he'd already drawn blood. I could see it running in a fresh trickle down her skin and under her culotte, staining it. Don't come any further. He was shaking hard. Mahdi? I kept my voice level, even though my mind was making a mad dash for an explanation. What the hell are you doing? I'm saving her. Mahdi's voice rose frantically. I checked how far we were from the wedding. Too far for anyone to hear him, no matter how loud he got. I'm saving Saida. Raise your hands where I can see them. I kept eye contact with Delilah as I did what he said, desperately trying to tell her it was going to be all right. I was not going to let her die here. What's in your hand? He called out urgently. The knife. I'm letting it go, I said, keeping my voice level. I unclenched my fist and let it drop. It planted blade down in the sand. I'm unarmed now. No, you're not. Mahdi pulled at Delilah, and she whimpered. He was frantic, manic, and that knife was awfully close to her throat. You've got an entire desert around you. He wasn't wrong. I could have him down in a handful of seconds if I wanted, but I couldn't make sure that knife didn't go through Delilah as he fell. Mahdi? I spoke carefully, the same voice I'd used to soothe a skittish horse. How exactly do you think sticking a knife to Delilah's throat is going to help Saida? She's a Demji. He spat out the words like it was obvious. Some people think that it's having part of a Demji that cures ills, but they're wrong. That's just peasant superstition. A few pieces of purple hair aren't going to bring my Saida back. He was unbalanced. He was desperate. He had a knife to Delilah's throat. I'd never wished more that I could move the desert without needing to move my body. I tried anyway, tugging at the edge of the sand with just my mind. It crept along reluctantly before sagging back down. I needed help. I've read books. Whosoever takes the life of a Demji shall have their life in equal measure. He recited like it was holy text, even though I knew it wasn't anything I'd ever heard preached. What's that supposed to mean? I had to buy some time, enough to think of a distraction. It means Saida can survive if she kills Delilah. I'd trade any Demji's life for Saida's, in a heartbeat. There, something behind him, a flash of movement in the moonlight. It darted silently from one shadow to the next. In a moment, as we passed from one tree to another, I got a clear view of him. Jin. I caught myself just quickly enough to flick my eyes back to Mahdi before he could notice where I was looking. He'd followed me after all. And he had a shot at getting us all out of here without bloodshed if I could just hold Mahdi's attention long enough. I didn't need a distraction. I was the distraction. And then what? I had to give Jin a chance to get close to him. What's your plan? Ahmed would never forgive you for killing his sister. You must know that. I don't care about Ahmed. Mahdi's accent was becoming more grating the more frantic he got. This whole rebellion is going to hell on a fast horse anyway. I'm pretty sure we're not the ones going to hell in this situation, I said. Jin was only 10 paces behind him now. Close enough, I saw the corner of his mouth pull up at my barb, even though his eyes never left his sister. Even you can see it, surely. Mahdi didn't seem to hear me. He was leaning forward desperately, like he could convince me, too. Like I might step aside and let him past. Ahmed has bitten off more than he can chew. Saramotai is just the beginning. There will be other uprisings, and the war with the foreigners will end, and the Sultan will destroy us. Ahmed is too weak to hold this whole country. We can't save everyone, so I'm saving someone I can. Jin was close now. Too close. The moonlight hit him as he left the cover of the trees, sending a spike of shadow across Mahdi's path. Mahdi's eyes went wide as he spun to face this new threat. His blade bit into the soft skin of Delilah's throat with a sudden motion, drawing blood. Delilah screamed. The time for distraction was done. I flung my arm in an arc, exploding a burst of sand right into Mahdi's face, blinding him as Jin darted forward. His hand latched over Mahdi's, twisting the knife away from Delilah's neck. It changed course, plunging toward Jin's chest instead. I whipped my palm flat, and the sand shifted below Mahdi's feet, throwing him off balance, the knife sailing harmlessly by Jin's shoulder. Mahdi went down, his fingers snapping like dry kindling in Jin's grip, the knife falling from his hand. He hit the sand with an agonized cry, even as Jin caught Delilah. And then it was over. Delilah collapsed into Jin, sobbing, a smear of blood from her neck darkening his desert white shirt. His eyes met mine over his sister's head. So much for avoiding him. Chapter 10. The stitched sun in the crown of the pavilion glowed dimly in the lamplight. It wasn't enough to fill the whole